Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Faith here with your welcome toast. Here's to the French who eat snails because they don't like fast food. It's great to have you joining the party on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze, inviting you to eat, drink, and be merry with us. We have a whopper for you this time. French recipes for the grill, yes, including a grilled flourless chocolate cake. Yes, yes, yes. We're going to go all French. You loved the beautiful boxed rosé wine we found for you. And guess what? That vineyard has decided to do a boxed red wine from the Rhône region. We're going to have a little tasting on the show. There are places that are recycling corks now, and there's this little debate about whether we should have plastic corks, regular corks, screw tops. So we might get into that a little bit toward the end of the show. And we rotate to Latin stuff again with the tamale. Where do you find the real deal? Because that's delicious. Our philosophy on the show is that I and my colleagues curate the best, tossing aside the rest. That's why you hear us raving about things. My food buddies are here, senior contributors Chris Prosperi and Alex Province, senior producer Robin Doyen Aiken. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Okay, our Food Schmooze studios are at the Big G, Gateway Community College, downtown New Haven. We play in the Big G's 5 culinary department, professional kitchens with every piece of equipment imaginable. All right, more French wine in a box. Alex, we talked about, and Chris, the place, Robin, the place went crazy because we had what we thought was one of the best rosés that we have been drinking lately. It yes. turns out they're making it in a box. And it went berserk in the market after we raved about it. And they sold out about 5 times. And so it's just like thousands of cases.
I'm only responsible for one of those times.
I'm responsible for 6 of these boxes. We've got a new box here from the same vineyard. Let me just say about the box wines. 4 bottles in this small box.
It doesn't look possible.
It does not look possible. It averages $8.50 a bottle this way.
Crazy.
It lasts forever in your fridge. You can keep it in there for months and months and months because there's no oxygen contact with the wine because of the spout. So, Alex.
First, you have to get over the fact that you're drinking wine out of a box because people, you know, historically think wine that comes in a box is bad. And that's simply not true.
Because some of it is bad.
Yeah. A lot of box wines today are inexpensive industrial wine. This is not that kind of wine.
Let's describe it. The box is sitting on the edge of the table.
Yeah.
You're
so
going to pour, Chris.
When you buy it, it's just a cardboard box. And there's a little perforated hole and you push on it and then you lift up this flap and out comes a spout.
Mm-hmm.
Just
you
like
have to kind of tug it a little bit.
Yep, you tug it out. If you peek inside the box, there's a silver bladder, so a recyclable silver bladder, and the wine is inside there. Chris is just pushing the little spout, and out comes the wine. It just pours out like
No drip.
There's like a little lever on it or something.
Yeah.
So
it's like a little wine fountain.
All right, so
I like
yes,
that.
I had another image, but anyway, this is the Vin de Lumière. And it is from the Côte du Rhône region, so it means it's a red.
Yeah, just in the very south of France, there's a river called the Rhône, and Côte is just hillside. So these are from the hills on this river. Grenache is the grape blended with a little bit of Syrah. And Grenache, remember, is that really juicy, fun, soft tannin, just summery,
and
easygoing wine.
So this is great with all the grilled foods, from grilled vegetables to even to grilled fish. I would have this with a grilled salmon, for
lamb chops.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So
perfect.
Just a quick stick fire with some lamb chops and kosher salt.
The Syrah gives it a little oomph. You know, it gives it a little backbone so that it can stand up against grilled chicken and grilled meat or a really sturdy pepper. And the Grenache is more sporty and fun. And we chill our red like this.
I love the chill on it.
Some people don't like it that way, but we all do. So this is about the size of, you know, Cascade dish detergent.
That's exactly the size.
What it is.
If you put...
With 30% free.
Yeah, yeah. That's the one. I was trying to figure out what's this box size. That's it. It's the Cascade dish detergent.
You have really clean dishes.
If you put two of those together... You would have this cardboard box, and the box is stamped. It has a handle on it. I went to a birthday party recently, and I love the rosé, which is very much like a Sancerre rosé. And I bought four or five of these and brought them to the party. Everyone came up to me and said, "This is delicious, Alex." Yeah. And they said, "How do I use it?" And I said, "Well, you just go like this, and it goes in your glass." So,
and three of those is a case of wine.
They said to me, "What do you mean there's four bottles in there?" So can you explain how that's possible, Alex? Because you just think it doesn't even visually make sense.
Well, most of the weight, when you pick up a wine bottle, most of it's glass. And so a case of wine of these 12 bottles, it's heavy without the wine.
Does that explain? Because they have not changed their production technique. This is very wholesomely made wine.
Exactly the same. So from a winery perspective, you're cutting costs because you're filling a four-bottle equivalent straight into this bladder. It's a lot easier for them. The cardboard is just plain cardboard. There's not fancy graphics. You're not paying for a cork. A cork can be upwards of, you know, like a quarter. A fancy one can be like a dollar. So you subtract all of these things. I mean, that's why they're saving money.
I'm ashamed of us because the one thing we're not talking about, people, is how this tastes.
Oh, it's amazing.
The best part.
You hear us talking about geeky things like tannins and stuff. It means that when that's in your mouth and that's the thing that gives it a little structure and makes it really quite delicious with food, there's a slight dryness on the edge of your tongue as you're swallowing. And that's tannins do that. We say that teabag effect where there's a little...
Sucks in a little.
Yeah, a little dryness, and it makes your mouth water a little bit. Those are the tannins. So that's what's coming from the Syrah in this wine. So... The Grenache, or Grenache, is...
A Spanish grape, actually. I had to say that.
And Spain invented that grape.
They invented wine.
You'll see why that's funny in a little bit. The combination of the two, how do we describe how those two things come together in the flavor of this wine?
The first thing people will notice is there's no sugar in these kinds of French wines. They ferment it all out. So compared to other box wines, this is dry. And then in Europe and France, they don't sell wine by the grape. They sell it by the region. So this blend might change from year to year. It might have more Syrah next year if the Syrah was better. So they want you to just see this as a red Côte de Rhône and then kind of say, hey, trust me, we make good wine, just buy it. And then the blending is up to them and they tweak it year by year because it's an agricultural product.
That's fascinating.
So you taste it, you're just tasting a blend. You know, the Syrah, like you said, Faith, gives it some, like, structure, and then the Grenache is like a party. And so together, it works well.
It's like smart and funny, right? It's
like,
that would be you. Okay. Love this. And so for this box with four bottles in it, it's $34, $35, and we have everything you need, including a picture. Go to foodschmooze.org and you'll see everything. And don't be embarrassed about putting this out because in Europe, these box wines are huge, especially in France,
they
right?
They really are. You could bring it to the boat. You can bring it camping, you know,
beach.
Places where you can't have glass. And then also for people that are like daily drinkers.
Glass of wine at lunch.
There's not a better
dinner.
Way of drinking because if you're a single person, pour what you need and it goes back in the refrigerator.
You
don't feel like you have to finish the bottle.
Or you have a project to do and you just want to have a glass of wine with your dinner. Yeah. This is the
way
to go.
Best way to do it.
I like to make pan sauces. And so
I want
a little pump of wine so I can put it in a pan with those little crispy bits from some piece of meat I've been cooking and a little pat of butter and swirl that pan around with a little splash of this wine and I'm good to go. It's just so useful. Some box wines we have here from some places are not good. I've tried them. I want to love them. No. Every once in a while you hit on one, this is a whole other story. Yeah. And people said to me after the rosé, oh, I wish they would make a red.
And here it is.
And it's good, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's really good. More than good. It's really good.
Yeah.
It's a great Côte d'Or.
This is not going to be that fruit-forward Pinot Noir style.
Nope.
This is more great with grilled meats, certain grilled vegetables.
Wine.
I would actually just sit around and drink this.
It's like a magic box, though. If we were to sit around, like you, it just goes on and on and on and on until you get the four bottles out. You're like wondering where the wine's coming from,
looking
for like a hose on the floor or something.
No, you are. I just keep saying,
where's the wine coming from?
Where? It's like a religious miracle.
If you carry three of these little boxes, like a cascade.
And you can very easily.
Very easily.
Very easily
handle,
carry three of these.
You've just carried a case of wine into your house. So for anyone who struggled to get like a case of wine in their house, into their car, into their pantry, wherever, if you can carry a cascade box, you can carry four bottles.
So let me ask this question. Is this, Chris, you have a restaurant. Is this convenient for a restaurant or as wine by the glass?
Yeah, it's convenient. And if you're closed on a Sunday and stuff, and that wine by Monday is no good anymore. I mean, it's sat for 2 days unless we pump it with the nitrogen or suck all the air out. I mean, there's all these other ways. But
if somebody would order these, I'd be thrilled.
I wish all our wines by the glass came in a box. It would make the bar run so much more efficiently.
Okay,
and
Vineyards,
the mountain of glass that we produce out of one small restaurant, it's mind-boggling.
Chris heard the dumpster.
Yeah, yesterday
turning
morning.
Turning over. He was in so early. He heard them.
Ear-shattering. It was so loud, and it lasted for so long. And I'm like, we fill that thing every single week. Think about how much glass that is.
As a diner, if you're doing wine by the glass, you're thinking, oh, I'm afraid the restaurant has ordered one of the cheapest wines they can get their hands on. To make a profit on this particular glass, that means that it might be a wine that's not wholesomely made. It's not healthy for me. It's not going to be that great. So that's why I'm onto this.
And maybe one day we'll even get to the point where we can actually sell this wine out of this box by the bottle like they do in Europe. When you go to Europe and you go to a bistro and you want their house wine, it comes in a carafe, big jug or something like this, and that's your wine. And it comes in a liter or three quarters of a liter carafe. It's red or white. Yep. And that's the way you should be drinking.
That's how they drink.
Yeah, that's how they drink.
So
red or white.
Now we're on to something where if for whatever reason you don't feel comfortable putting out one or two boxes of this wine because it would be eight bottles.
One box or two?
Never mind. Never mind. Okay, so you put out one bottle. If you don't want to do that, do what the French bistros do and put it into a very large carafe.
Put it in carafes. Put it on the table. Let everyone drink it. Let everyone see it. And then at the end, ask your guests, what do you think of the wine? And let everyone give their opinion. And then come out with the empty box and say, that's what it came in. Yeah. This is the new thing now that these great wines are coming in this simple package. It's so much better for the environment, too.
When you're done, you just take the cardboard. It goes in a single stream with the plastic, and you're all done.
I know. We have really gone on about this because we've gotten into the whole thing again about box wines and what's going on in the marketplace and all that. It's just so fun to talk about. And we get to talk about winemaking in general. Coming up later in the show, we have this cookbook that I'm nuts about called French Grill. And we want to talk with you about tamales. Now, I don't know tamales. I am just learning about them. But I just had some that were so good. And we want to know from you about where you find your best tamales. We're going to do French Grill next, including that grilled flourless chocolate cake. So don't go anywhere. More mouthwatering conversation and fun ahead on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. I hope you will make a charitable contribution to feed the hungry. They need us. We're online now at foodschmooze.org, and we'll be right back.
Sous le ciel de Paris s'envole une chanson. Elle est née d'aujourd'hui dans le cœur d'un garçon.
I'm Faith Middleton. You can sign up for our free podcast, meaning a copy of each week's show. It'll arrive in your inbox every single week. You just go once to foodschmooze.org, sign up, and that's it. The point is you can listen on your schedule. It's that simple. Okay, I have been waiting for this. I can't tell you. When Paris-Provence food expert Patricia Wells raves about an American cookbook, I pay attention. The same with food historian Laura Shapiro, who did Julia Child's biography. What are they and I knocked out by? This cookbook, French Grill. The creator is Susan Herman Loomis. It's a genius idea to do French recipes for the grill, I think. Camembert burgers, grilled chicken livers and onions on skewers, smoky French-style gazpacho, salmon with tarragon butter grilled on the skin. There is even, wait for it, a grilled flourless chocolate cake. That's on our website, foodschmooze.org. Susan Herman Loomis does cookbooks, writes for all the food publications that so many of us know. And she owns and operates her own cooking school in a 12th century convent in Normandy, France, the life many of us would like to lead. Welcome to the Food Schmooze Party, Susan.
Thank you, Faith. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're making a claim, a delicious claim, that the French invented barbecue. Mais non, madame, that can't be true. It's true, though.
Mais oui, madame. Of course it's true. If you live in France long enough, you do begin to understand the French invented almost everything. And when you start studying the history of gastronomy, what you find out is the Gauls were grilling in France, and they were grilling good stuff. They had a way with meats, and they had a way with fish, and they had a way with fowl, and it was all grilled over fire. I mean, it's a claim to be made. So
yes,
made
it's absolutely a claim to be made. So I'm just going to give that to you.
Thank you, Faith. I appreciate that. I really do.
I can't wait to get into some of these recipes. And you know, I'm just dying to tell everybody about the grilled flourless chocolate cake. But to begin with, how would you describe this? You took recipes of yours that are based on real French tradition and then adapted them for the grill?
Really, the impetus was my realization after living here for 30 years, really, that everyone around me, from the moment the sun shines, is grilling. No one expects the French to grill. No one outside of France knows the French grill, but they grill like crazy. And I thought, you know, this is an untouched subject.
We asked Chris to make this recipe, which is also on our website, and it is your salmon with tarragon butter grilled on the skin with this grilled potato salad that made us go crazy.
Oh,
one of those vinegary.
Did
we say this is the best potato salad we've ever had?
Yeah, no question. Yeah, by far one of the best potato salads
I've ever had. Amazing. If you love that vinegary style.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how this works. Salmon fillet with olive oil, some butter, sea salt, fresh tarragon leaves, a squeeze of lemon juice, and off you go. Go ahead.
So grilling salmon on the skin is classic because the heat comes up through the skin protects the flesh of the fish, and you have this perfectly cooked, beautiful piece of fish on the grill. It takes about 8 minutes. And then you also get this amazing crisp piece of skin. And if you've never bitten into a piece of grilled salmon skin,
Yum.
You haven't really lived.
Oh, my arms are in the air. I'm cheering. It's one of my favorite things to eat. If we were saying this in French, would you say it for me? This is the salmon with tarragon butter grilled on the skin. What would that sound like?
C'est le saumon gris à l'unilatéral.
Yes,
and
yes.
Unilatéral means one side. So you don't touch it. You leave it on the grill. You take a spatula and you take the flesh off the skin, put that on a plate, and then you take the skin off the grill. So it's easy. You don't want the flesh of the salmon to touch the grill.
And
you want all that heat and a little bit of smoke to go around the fish and cook it that way.
So if it's a gas grill, the lid is closed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And with
charcoal too.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's the beauty of the grill.
Also on the site, we have a fuchsmoose.org plus information about this cookbook. And I am, believe me, happy to pass that information on. The grilled new potato salad that you did with it, Chris, we were just talking about.
It's an easy recipe. I love the vinaigrette. The potatoes are blistering. When I toss the dressing on it, they're still warm, so it's soaked right
soaks
up.
It
absolutely
right up. Wow.
Heaven. So you basically cook these potatoes and get them nice and charred. I cheated a little bit and finished them in the oven because I'm impatient, but that's not a bad thing, right?
It's not a bad thing, but I have to tell you, it doesn't potatoes, new potatoes especially, yeah. cook so fast on yeah. the grill.
So yeah. this is a measure. Oh. This is like a yeah. measuring stick of patience.
It's not the potatoes, it's me. But anyway, you take vinegar and maple syrup. It just made it sing. A little bit of maple syrup, salt, a little smoked paprika, olive oil, tarragon, parsley, lemon zest, and some thinly sliced spring onions. And it makes this amazing vinaigrette.
So this piment d'Espelette is a paprika. Can you explain that to me? Because I use the Spanish paprika.
Olé.
The pimentón. Okay, so tell me about this one.
Piment d'Espelette is from the Basque country. And there's a little town called Espelette where the houses are all painted bright white on the outside. The peppers, they only grow around this town. This is a pedigree pepper. And when they're harvested, they're strung and hung from the eaves over the house. So you see these white houses with these bright red strings of peppers.
Very cool.
And it's gorgeous. They're not smoked, though, like the Spanish yeah. peppers. They're dried, and then they're ground, and then you have this incredible... Like paprika, there's a little bit of heat at the back of your throat, a little bit. Mm. I wouldn't call it super spicy, but the flavor of this pepper is incredible. I just love it. You go to the Basque country, and on the table you'll have a little bowl of this pepper mix with a little bit of fleur de sel. I use it all the time.
So, Chris, easy to do
easy
if
to
you
do.
Have just
and
a tiny bit of patience as the potatoes cook.
And the flavor, right?
The vinegar flavor is coming from both the sherry vinegar. But
and a little bit of lemon.
Lemon so and then that. Just that touch of maple syrup to
yeah.
balance it all out. Mm. Now, maple syrup, we were just saying, in France is become so expensive. So not that it's free here, but we're lucky to have access to
yeah.
it here.
It is expensive here, although we have a food co-op. You know, there are food co-ops all over France, and you can get it there. It doesn't cost a bomb. And you don't use very much. Use a tablespoon.
In this recipe, it was a drop. It's just to balance out the sherry vinegar. It's not like...
It is.
It didn't give it like this great sweetness.
There's a recipe here, and I can't wait to ask you about this because I love gazpacho. Sometimes I think to myself, what would happen if I grilled the tomatoes? And what do I find but your gazpacho, smoky and French style? Alex is Spanish, and he is... an extraordinary gazpacho maker. So,
thank
Alex,
you.
This is really for you. So olive oil, medium tomatoes, onion, cucumber, garlic, lemon juice, and again, this piment d'Espelette and a fresh basil.
You want to do this over the coals because you want that smoke. So I put some grapevine cuttings on the grill right before I put the tomatoes on. I grill the tomatoes and I grill a bell pepper till they're charred. And put them in a bowl to catch all the juices, and then really whip it up with the pepper and add the spicing and the vinegar, and that is it.
Garlic. And you chill it, obviously, right?
Then I chill it, yeah. The first time I made it, I have a wine tasting group here that we meet once a month, and I served it. It was too cold. Now, that's a French thing, though. They're like, this would be better if it wasn't so cold. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So
they don't like the refrigerator.
You want to take it out so it's not, like, freezing cold.
Hmm. To have just a chill on it, you can taste the flavors more, correct?
That's it.
Yeah.
And it's simple like all the recipes, like French food is. Simple.
I am so proud of our farm products
yeah.
in America. So please don't misunderstand me. I support and go to farmers markets every second that I can. However, when I go to France and to Italy, there is something about the vegetables I have there where I have never tasted anything like them. I'll say I've never tasted an artichoke before. Mm. I've never tasted this before or that before. I've tried to bring the seeds back and grow them here. It's not the same. It's not the same climate,
it's not
soil,
seeds, yeah.
water.
Yeah, it's everything.
So can we achieve what you achieve in France, say, at your cooking school? Can we achieve that here?
I think you can. Just to go back, that word terroir that you hear so much, it's the landscape, it's the heart of the people who are growing the vegetables. Everything goes into the flavor of a vegetable or wine or anything that's grown. So every vegetable tastes different depending on where it's raised. All the recipes in French Grill were tested in the U.S. at least once by people who, you know, mostly had markets, but not always, because I want to make sure they're good for everybody. If somebody came back to me and said, no flavor, boring, whatever, I didn't put it in the book. So, yes, you can achieve the flavors in the U.S. with the recipes in this book.
This is Susan Herman Loomis, and we are talking about her book, and I'm really quite excited about this. It's called French Grill. She's had the, I think, brilliant idea of taking 125 French recipes, and these are what people in France, how they grill. And these are also Susan's recipes, and she has a cooking school in Normandy in a 12th century convent. I mean, it's just the most incredible thing. And a wine club. She was taunting us with the information about the wine club.
You're all invited.
Thank you. Here's an idea of creating a camembert, you know, this cheese that so many of us love. So this is a camembert burger. And Susan says it is the best cheeseburger you've ever had. So once again, she says it's a throwdown. So this is medium fat ground beef, salt and pepper, a little ground allspice. There's a little secret ingredient, fresh parsley, and the camembert. So we saw camembert used during the old silver palette days with Sheila Lukens, where she would put it into a pasta. And it was the kind of thing where it was so rich that you felt I should go to the hospital and lie down. So, on the other hand, it was so crazily delicious. And I have a feeling this burger, I haven't tried this, but I want to. Go ahead, Susan.
I played with this, I will admit. But, you know, I live in Normandy where apples are one of the main things that's grown here. We have gorgeous beef from the Norman cow. We have camembert from the milk of the Norman cow. And I was having fun with this idea, and I know how much Americans love burgers. I know how much French love burgers. So I thought this is really a genuflection to my region, where I took the main ingredients and put them in a burger. And I have to say, I don't even know if I believe in cooking camembert or melting it or anything, because it's so good just by itself. But I believe it for this recipe because it's perfect.
Mm. Well, here we all have been waiting for this.
Drum roll, please.
This recipe that has just got me wild. It is a flourless chocolate cake on the grill. In some version of heaven, when I'm asleep and thinking it must contain food just the way I want it to be, this is definitely on the menu. So
it's funny how this came about. I made dinner, had a group of friends over. We're sitting out in the back courtyard, and it's all beautiful, and the lights are on. And I'm looking at the grill. You know, everything's cooked, and there's all this heat. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's bacon temperature. So I literally ran in the house and made a flourless chocolate cake, which takes 2 seconds. And put it in a pan, put it on the grill, forgot about it for 20 minutes, and opened the grill, and it was a cake. I mean, why not?
How is it different from an oven? Does the chocolate take on any smoke? Is it different from if we baked it in the oven?
To be honest with you, it's really not, unless you have a lot of smoke in your grill, which I don't recommend. So what you have is residual heat in any grill, charcoal grill. So I just wanted to use it and see if it would work. And guess what? It works for cakes and cookies and buns and all kinds of stuff.
So what we've got is, if you're using really great chocolate, you've got something that is just like with sous vide, that sort of poaching liquid that makes things velvety.
This cake is so incredibly delicious that I think, remember, the temperature is, it's actually 400 Fahrenheit. So it's oven temperature. And it stays that way for a good half hour after you take your grilled food off of it. So it's efficient. So your dessert's baking right next to you while you're having dinner.
Cool. Neighbors are going crazy as they smell your chocolate cake.
Think of this. People are over for dinner, and you say, excuse me, I have to go over and put our chocolate cake on the grill. You know, I would just kiss that person on the lips who said those words.
Well, I'll tell you, the recipe is so French, and it's served so often.
Susan's instructions are place that chocolate and butter and salt in a small pan over low heat. You let them melt, stir it a little bit. And when it's melted, you take it off the heat. And then with an electric mixer or a whisk, you do the eggs and sugar until they're all kind of foamy. And then these things go together.
Fold together.
And
that
then it into a pan onto the grill it goes.
Simple as that.
That's simple. Really, anybody can do that.
Yeah.
And I'm a terrified baker. I couldn't do this.
But, you know, I grew up with a mother who had fear of flour.
Because she was gluten sensitive or because...
No, because she didn't like to bake and she didn't... We didn't have those kinds of desserts. And she said, I just have fear of flour.
Using that. I have fear of flour.
Yeah, so flourless chocolate cake is made for them. And this is also a good recipe for kids. Because it's for sure going to succeed, so everybody's proud.
Well, what kind of chocolate do you personally use?
Either Valrhona or Lindt. They're miles apart in some ways, but Lindt is actually an excellent baking chocolate.
Yep.
52 to 60% is what you want. That's semi-sweet. You don't want to use anything darker than a 60% because there's not enough sugar in it to add moisture to the cake.
Yep.
You see what I'm saying?
We've tried it with a high percentage, and it comes out very dry.
It's dry, and everybody cries, and nobody gets it. And it's all about sugar and cacao, and, you know, it's the balance. So that's why I give the percentage.
Semi-sweet. Yeah.
This is where baking is a science. This is,
you know.
That's why I'm afraid of flour. I'm going to
use that. But I know. I look at percentage and I go, oh, my God, I'm so bad at math. But it's just semi-sweet.
Drop the one.
Have someone do it for you. Yeah, exactly.
Just go back to semi-sweet, bittersweet, milk, you know.
Those were the days.
So, Faith, I'm thinking the smokiness in the cake might actually be a nice thing, right? A little bit?
But, you know, you want to be careful with smoke, in my opinion, because I think sometimes we prefer smoke over flavor. And I say that in these recipes. It's like, this is not about big, smoky, big, fat, barbecue-y things. It's about incredibly delicious food cooked on the grill. And the grill enhances it. But you don't want the smoke to take over.
Mm-hmm.
You have to play with that.
Yeah.
I think it would be good in this cake, but you don't want too much because then you don't taste the chocolate.
And we can have wine that's too cold as opposed to too smoky, and therefore we can't taste it.
And that happens all the time, especially with white wine.
Yeah, except when it comes to rosé. I love my rosé very cold. And my champagne, ice cold. And my beer.
Champagne, I will agree with you 1,000%.
You do? I thought for sure, as a French person, you
No, because warm champagne is really not that much fun.
Nope.
I experiment with that a lot, and I'm here to tell you.
I really need to do that.
Your assignment for this weekend.
Inspiration. I really appreciate it.
A glass of champagne here. I should try it.
Yeah. Warm. Let's put it back in the fridge.
Let's try it cold.
Oh, my God. You're the best. That's the first thing. You, Susan.
Thank you
very much for doing this book. It's such a smart idea.
Oh, thank you for telling your part of the work about it. I really hope that people will get it and use it and really, really have fun in the grill because I must say I certainly did.
How about we lead a food and wine tour and we come over and see you in that cooking school?
I think that is a great idea.
Chris, you have your calendar out.
Okay.
Get your calendar out, get a group together, and I'll be here.
Okay, Susan. Watch out. Thank you. Susan Herman Loomis, and the book is called French Grill. And you will see recipes from the book, including the chocolate cake and that salmon with the potatoes on the grill, that potato salad that was made, that vinegary, most astonishingly delicious thing. That's on our website, too, foodschmooze.org. Hey, guess what? We found a place where you can recycle your wine bottle corks. And there's a reason they want you to do it. You'll see. We love the local. Please support your local food growers and food makers. And for an on-demand podcast of the Food Schmooze Party every week, go to foodschmooze.org. That's where all the recipes are. And, of course, we'll be right back. Mais à Paname, tout peut s'arranger. Quelques rayons du ciel d'été, l'accordéon d'un marinier, l'espoir fleurit au ciel de Paris.
chorizo, chorizo, chorizo. Whoa, oh, oh, oh.
This is the Food Schmooze Party, offering the richness of life and coming to you in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including Westchester County, the East End of Long Island, the Hamptons, of course. The senior producer is Robin Doyen Aiken, plus we love her. To hear the show on Connecticut Public Radio, it airs Thursdays at 3 and 9 and Saturdays at noon. We have podcasts, our curated recommendations, always online, waiting to make you happy at foodschmooze.org. We have an assignment for you on Facebook because I want to know. Tamales. I'm just getting into them. I'm just discovering the real deal. I want to know from you on Facebook, if you are a tamale fan and you know where they're making really good ones, please just go on there and tell us. It's Faith Middleton Food Schmooze on Facebook. This is our segment on tamales. It was Alex's idea. He spends half his time now in Phoenix, Arizona.
In a cookbook that we love, we found Tucson tamales as listing one of their recipes. Apparently, people in Arizona at Christmas time give tamales as presents.
They do?
Yeah. I want to be on your Christmas
list.
So
it's like you bring Christmas cookies, you'd bring Christmas tamales. So Tucson Tamale is this company in Tucson that still makes them by hand. It's Sherry's like mother's recipe.
Here's the story. This guy, Todd Martin, he falls in love with tamales and he falls in love with this woman,
Sherry.
You know, and he marries her. And he's making tamales with her family. And he said, we got to make tamales. We got to do this as a business because these tamales are really good. And by the way, if you go to TucsonTamale.com, you will find, you can put in your zip code and it will tell you where they're sold here. We know, in fact, in New Haven, where our studio is in particular, they're sold at Edge of the Woods Co-op. Let's explain what tamales are.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So they're wrapped in
corn husk.
Yep, simple.
Sometimes a banana leaf.
And depending
many,
on where they're from.
Many Latin cultures mm-hmm. make tamales.
Mm-hmm. And you pointed out they're over 7,000 years BC. They've been making some form of tamale.
Yep. So they have this company, Tucson Tamale, has jalapeno and cheese, blue corn and veggie, green chili and cheese, black bean and cheese for the plant-based people, green chili chicken tamales, and those were my favorite.
Yeah,
they were pretty
good.
Alex liked the pork.
Yeah.
But anyway, what's the deal on how you make these?
It's basically three parts.
It takes them 1 to 2 days, by the way, to make the real thing. Go ahead.
You have a husk, and basically you have a dough that's made from corn flour.
Yep, masa.
It's almost like making a biscuit. They'll take pork fat or lard, and they'll whip it together like you're making chocolate chip cookies, like with Crisco or something, right? And so then they take the flour, and they put it into the whipped up fat.
What flour?
Masa corn flour, it's white, mm-hmm. goes into this whipped up lard. It's naturally gluten-free. And so then with their hands, with a little broth, they'll mix this batter for 15 minutes and they do it in a huge bowl. And it turns into like almost like a jello texture, like this really sort of peanut buttery dough.
Did you watch this in a video or did you go someplace?
Yeah, so I really got into tamales. It's mm-hmm. like a whole world of tamales.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll take this dough and they'll spread it on the corn husk.
Yeah.
And then they'll take a flavoring, in this case,
filling.
Like pork, a filling.
Yeah.
And the pork is like a braised 3-hour mm-hmm. pork and water with garlic sure. and bay leaves. It gets shredded. And then they'll take, remember, Faith, those chilies that come in the cellophane bags? So those are all over the Southwest.
Oh,
and
they'll
take that and they'll put it in hot water and reconstitute it. And you blend it until it's like a sauce. So that sauce goes into the pork, into the filling. You smear this dough onto the leaf. You pour it like a little mohawk of your filling.
Yeah.
And then you fold one side over, fold the other side over, and tuck under the tail. And then it gets steamed for 60 minutes.
Yeah.
And it smells like corn and it's like the filling. And you open it up and you have this little pocket.
It's like a hot pocket.
A little Mexican pocket.
It is like a hot pocket. So, of course, this got me. My mind was racing with things to do. I was all of a sudden thinking, I have to put Palacios.
Chorizo
in here. I have to, with this cornmeal.
Faith, you're onto something.
I was, where was I? riverhead on the east end of Long Island, and there is this little Mexican place down a slight alleyway that people pointed me to. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the name. And it was filled with Mexican people. It was so delicious, and I ordered a tamale. Oh, and I unwrapped it, and they were all standing staring to see if I liked it. You know,
and
because
you did,
they,
right?
I loved it.
Have you made them?
Yeah, so I forgot. This is how it all sort of started. I saw them in the deli case. You know, in Arizona, they're everywhere. So then I started researching how to make it, and this is where I came across the recipe. But I have learned making the pork is easy. The dough is more effort. But I'm just buying from Tucson Tamale because it's something that's, like, easier just to
– they're delicious.
To buy from someone who knows
wow.
how to do it.
Wow, seriously.
Have a tamale party and make them if you wanted to do
so
it.
So now I'm
– yeah,
so, I made them once. They have such history. They've been around forever. It's how we used to eat. So I got really intrigued and started researching and the different masas and how to do it. And then I set out and I got all the ingredients. And Faith said it at the beginning. They take 2 to 3 days to make.
Here's
My kitchen
what happens.
Looked like a bomb went off.
No, you start and then you're on Social Security before you finish.
So now you just find the best one that you can get.
I really at home want to find a way. Yeah. How could we do this? Honestly, I don't need to make my pasta from scratch.
You don't need to make your tamales either.
Tamales are one of those things you don't need to make.
I'm not going to do it.
If you want to take a weekend.
Yeah.
I can't.
And then eat tamales for the next
one. But how could I do this a fast way? You're going to laugh at me. Could I make polenta and then add all the things I'd like to add to it? Chorizo?
It's kind of a good idea.
The green chilies.
The texture might be different,
And what am I wrapping it with? Banana leaf, or can I buy?
I would use corn husks.
Can I use parchment paper? No,
yes.
The corn's going to flavor.
Well, you
it,
could. You could use parchment paper.
Corn husks from when I have my fresh corn.
There you go.
Just wrap it, right? And then I'm steaming it.
Steam it upright for 60 minutes, and it's as simple as that.
You guys have more energy than I have.
No, what are we going to?
I still have PTSD from the time I made them. First of all, it took me at least 20 of them to get the folding right. It actually
gets two wings.
Yeah, it gets two little wings and they're folded over. And then you can even take little pieces of corn husk and make strips and tie it in little bows. And I'm like, just buy them.
We grew up various reasons. I grew up in an Italian family for quite a lot of the time of my growing up. And Grandma Pinto had brought the breadboard from Italy. On Grandma Pinto's board, we make ravioli from scratch with bresaola and sausage and pepperoni all in the sauce, and we do the whole thing. You cannot believe the fights and the arguments over the dough is too thin. No, I like it thick. I mean, honestly.
That's not how I do it.
It's like, oh, my God. So, but it takes all day on Thanksgiving to go through all this.
If you watch people make these traditional things, even enchiladas, I thought, oh, it's so easy. They fry it first, and then you put it in the salsa, and then you just roll it. And if you watch someone who's grown up doing this, they're so good at it. So I'm trying to roll my enchiladas. They're in the fat, and then they're sliding off the plate, and then the tongs break them, and then they fall in the salsa and turn into mush. My hands are covered. I'm rubbing my eyes. And they make something look so easy, and it's not. So.
I know. Yeah,
It's like the I Love Lucy episode.
No, it is.
These are enchiladas, so sure.
Yeah. It's easy. No, no. Some things are easy. That's not easy.
No. Well, we have had a ball with these, eating these, Tucson Tamale Company.
Right?
Thank you very much for sending them.
You guys know what you're getting for Christmas.
Yes, totally. I totally want to be on your Christmas list.
Okay, we're going to do a little traveling music.
So I went down to the corner and found my boy. Made him chip in on a bottle of joy to get my head happy with wine, don't you know? Head happy with wine, don't you know? Head happy with wine, don't you know? I'm gonna get high once more.
You heard us talking about this Rhone red that's in a box. And of course, there's no cork in that box. So we said, let's switch things around and talk about the art of corks for wine. And what do we do with all those corks? Because cork is a precious material. And we found Peter Weber. He is a Yale grad, so he certainly knows New Haven. He's executive director in California of the nonprofit Cork Quality Council. And he has worked out a deal with some places in Connecticut where you can actually recycle your real cork. So we're going to get to that. Peter, welcome to the Food Schmooze Party.
Glad to be here, Faith.
What got you into this cork thing?
I've been in the wine business for many years. A friend of mine who was in the cork business told me that they had this trade association, and I started this 15 years ago. This is by far my favorite project.
Peter, are all corks the same? If it's a cork, I don't mean the plastic corks, that's a whole other story, but if it's seemingly a cork material, are they all the same? Is that a precious material?
There are many different kinds of corks, and they behave differently. And yes, I think it is a precious material.
You have this thing, the Cork Quality Council. I'm assuming that that started because they were running into some problems, right? Certain corks were seeping. There was a little bit of sort of mold, mildew getting into the wines because of them. Is that right?
Well, that is right. And quality control is very important. And one of the first things that we wanted to attack was this mildewy off aroma called cork taint. And they asked me to try to find a way to do that. And I think we've accomplished that goal several years ago. We're proud of it.
What did you do? How did you do that?
Well, the cork taint is actually a residual chemical from microorganisms. It's common in pretty much any kind of wood product. I smell it myself when I go to the store, apples, raisins, carrots. The problem is people don't take their carrot up and hold it under their nose and regard it before they consume it. So the TCA in the wine was much more noticeable only because obviously we do smell our wine before we drink it.
I have a good friend, Don, who used to say that he could smell this taint in apples. And then all of us, you know, are like, really? Who? You've just proven him to be correct. There is cork taint or the same chemical on things like apples.
So that does raise the question why we should use corks at all if they're so porous. Why don't we go straight screw top? What do you think, Peter?
When I said that the commodity is precious, I didn't mean it was rare. The cork forest in the Mediterranean is over 5.5 million acres, and there's plenty of cork to go around. Besides, obviously, when you harvest cork, you're just taking the bark off the tree. You're not cutting the tree down. And those trees in that forest are vitally important to the Mediterranean region. So actually, people at the World Wildlife Federation and whatnot are very much in support of using cork because they want to preserve those cork trees as a valuable resource. From a closure quality standpoint, a good cork is very much better than an alternative. And frankly, the leaking of corks is almost always associated with the bottling conditions, not so much the material.
Like the bottle got too hot and the contents pushed out, right?
That can happen, or it can freeze, same thing.
Chris,
So why recycle, and what do they do with the corks? Do they reuse them?
Sure. They really repurpose them. We work with several partners in Connecticut. There's one company called Cork Reharvest. They generally have collection locations at every Whole Foods store. There's another company called Recork. They originally were, they still are a very large shoe company. They wanted to make their cork insoles out of recycled cork.
Yeah,
I just got off the phone earlier this morning with the executive director of the Darien Nature Center. They raise money by recycling corks there as well. So there's some places locally.
So I understand that people are reusing cork for other materials. This is all part of a recycling philosophy.
I think it comes down to the fact that most consumers prefer cork. A good cork, I think, makes the wine taste better.
Yeah, isn't that psychologically proven? Isn't that a fact that the sound of a cork coming out of wine, like, puts us in a certain mood and gets us ready for that wine?
Absolutely. I believe you're referring to a study performed last year, I think, in Oxford. We have seen the same results when it's done with pictures, now when it's done with sound. When people think they're drinking wine from a cork-finished bottle, they think it's better.
Right. This is one of those things where people could really get into some interesting debates. Thank you so much, Peter. And thanks for passing on the info about the recycling program. Really appreciate that.
Sure.
Peter Weber, who is a Yale grad, he knows New Haven. He's executive director of the nonprofit Cork Quality Council. We are on Connecticut Public Radio Thursdays at 3 and 9 and Saturdays at noon. Weekdays, listen for my 60-second food schmoozes and never eat more than you can lift. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton. Hey, don't want the party to end? Well, neither do we. Talk with us anytime online at foodschmooze.org.